is Thanksgiving week, and that means that we're all getting ready for turkey, I guess. A couple of years ago, I attended a Thanksgiving, and everybody was vegan. And it was funny. They had a vegan turkey, and I wasn't expecting to really enjoy it, but with the flavorings they added, and of course, this is all natural. Vegans are vegan, if you don't know what that means, is somebody who doesn't eat any meat of any kind, any dairy, anything that's produced from a cow, no meats, no dairy, and so they eat a lot of tempeh and a lot of fruits and vegetables. And this turkey, this vegan turkey, actually, it wasn't an actual turkey. You know, they didn't form it into a bread-looking turkey. It was slices of looked like it actually wasn't too bad. Had a kind of a strange aftertaste, but hey, everybody has Thanksgiving. So if you're vegan, welcome to it. If you're vegetarian, great. And if you're a carnivore, which is most of us, I guess, that's you have the bird. So happy Thanksgiving week to you. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. And just as a reminder, remember, they're offering a special package. If you go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients, it's gaia.com/Earth Ancients. They have a page that's designed for you, the listener, of a bunch of speakers that we've had on the show, but also they have a dynamite a page. They have a pyramid page with Dave Wilcox. They have Graham Hancock, hundreds and hundreds of speakers, and they're offering a special program for 99 cents to start. You can see these speakers from around the world on one page. And it's everything from streaming media to lecture series to special documentaries. There's a number of documentaries on ancient China, ancient Europe, and even ancient America that are quite fascinating. So when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. After the 99 cent first month, it's about $9 a month. Hundreds of updated new products are being submitted to them, and it's a really, really good site, and it's really interesting to have a sponsor that is in alignment with what we do here on Earth Ancients. A lot of their topics are right in line with what we're doing here, so check them out, gaia.com/Earth Ancients. I posted a new article on the website. If you go to earthancients.com, a new article called Maya Conspiracy, which I actually just updated. It's part of a an article that I wrote about 3 years ago on this very interesting sculpture that came out of Guatemala. And it's a sculpture that looks like a pilot that is flying what you would normally see flying in a jet. And this figure is wearing a helmet with a face mask, an air mask. He's got heavy clothing on, and he's cut off at the waist like he was placed in some kind of a – it looks like he may have come out of a bigger sculpture of some kind of – I'm going to say some kind of object of some kind of flying vehicle. And the article originally was called The Guatemala Pilot. And it was picked up by a lot of different publications and magazines a couple of years ago. And I've put it on the website, earthancients.com, for you to read in its complete state. If you want to read some updated material, you can go to the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, earthancients.com, and you can check it out there. Also, always check out the website. And if you haven't registered yet, get on there to register. I'm going to be giving away before the end of the year, another ebook. Haven't decided which one it's going to be, but the way to stay up on material and always, you know, be one of the people that gets one of these free ebooks is to register on the homepage. You know, you just go to the earthancients.com, and if you scroll to the bottom, you'll see the registration form, and that is how you will get on to MailChimp. The other good thing about that is I'm producing a monthly newsletter, and you'll be able to get a copy of that automatically. You'll be automatically part of that. So, website, check it out. This week on the Facebook page, George Haas from the Sidonian Institute sent me a new photograph. Apparently, the European Space Agency has been taking photographs for the last year of the surface of Mars, and they've sent a bunch of new images. And there's a section of just, I guess, south of Cydonia, and they just discovered a new step pyramid. And not only that, they discovered a series of other pyramids and buildings that are fascinating. And I spoke to George earlier this week. We're going to do a special program that includes Dr. John Brandenburg, George Haas of the, you know, like I just said, he's from the Cydonia Institute, and a couple of other people in a program called The Ruins of Mars. It's going to be Saturday, December 5th, right here on Earth Ancients. And this is going to be an update. Now, a lot of people, you know, when they look at these photographs, go, well, that's looks like a pile of rocks, or it looks like a mountain or something like that. But if they look really closely, if you zero in on your browser and really look closely, you'll see that a lot of these are actual ruins. And the thing that's hard for a lot of people to realize is that these ruins are hundreds of thousands of years old. Now, Dr. Brandenburg wrote a book called Death on Mars, and he is, with some other scientists, believe that he's actually shown with evidence that two major nuclear weapons were blown up over the atmosphere, which basically killed the planet and killed the living, the civilizations that were on there. And that was over a million years ago. So these ruins are hundreds of thousands to a million years ago. When you look at them, you can actually see evidence. There's evidence of different kinds of pyramids. There's some magnificent buildings. The Eye of Horus is one that's quite fascinating. So anyhow, December 5th, Saturday the 5th, we're going to have Dr. Brandenburg, George Haas, and a couple of other people in a panel discussion. The theme is Ruins of Mars. So stay tuned to that. That's coming up. I'm fascinated by Mars. I think that's so much to see there that we're just not paying attention to. I have a gallery I posted a couple of days ago on the Facebook pages of El Tijin, which is a ruin in the Veracruz area of Mexico. And this is a pyramid culture. And these pyramids that I've posted, and it's a large, large gallery that was submitted, are very unusual pyramids. They look like little, as you look at it, it looks like it's a cluster of little rooms with open windows. And these pyramids, you know, are 200 feet in the air or taller. And this is a gallery of fascinating ruins. And we just don't know enough of these people that are the that built these places. They're so fascinating. The engineering, the thought behind them, and what was going on then? What was their thinking? So anyhow, check that out. It's on the Facebook page, and it's a chance to see a pyramid culture. Now remember, we're going to be going to Mexico April 2nd through 8th. And that's the tour Path of the Sacred Maya. Now, I've reevaluated the costs, and I personally thought it was too high. So we have made deep cuts into the cost of this tour. In fact, we discounted it about $600. And if you register now, or before the end of the year, you'll get an extra $200 discount. And if you go to the earthancients.com page, you can see the entire itinerary, April 2nd through 8th, 2017. We all fly into Mérida. And then we get to see this fascinating Maya pyramid culture. We go to Mayapan. We go to five different places, Chichen Itza, Ekbalam, Koba, and Uxmal, which has the only oval pyramid in the world. And we'll be accompanied by Miguel Angel, and he is a Mayan shaman who will kind of provide us with ceremony and kind of activate these places. It's just a wonderful opportunity. I traveled with Maya elders and shaman, and when you're with them and you're walking in these ruins, it just kind of invigorates the tour and also creates a special sacredness to these areas that is really important and really a benefit. Every time I come home and I'm with elders and shaman, it's just, I've changed. I've either shifted or something's happened. It's just amazing. So please join me. And if you did sign up already, we will extend the discounts to you. So go to the earthancients.com and check it out. April 2nd through 8th. Come on out and join me. It's going to be a blast. I'm really looking forward to it.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And this time we go to Kazakhstan in Northern Europe. And if you don't know where that Kazakhstan is, it's it borders Russia and China. Local people were walking out in a field a couple of miles from their town, and they just discovered a 300-acre stone monument that was built, what they believe, by the Huns. It's a couple thousand years old. Some of the stones are, it's like 13 by 13 feet high. Others are 80 feet wide by 100 feet wide. These are massive structures. They don't actually know specifically what was done there, but if you go to this page on the Facebook Earth Ancients group, you can see some of these photographs. Some of the carving is extremely ornate. In fact, the main photograph shows images that kind of are similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs, but they're different. And then there's these piles of rocks all spread out over 30 acres. It's a monstrous place to check out. And we keep finding more and more of these ancient locations, and people are stumbling over them. So check that out. It's kind of interesting. Always something to look at. And if you're sending me this material, keep doing that. It's just amazing. All these new discoveries. It's fun. It's totally interesting. This week, we are talking about Mu, Lemuria, or Pan. And I've been fascinated by Lemuria simply because we've had Native Elder on the show. We had Clifford Mahuti, who talked about the migration from Mu into Mexico and up to Arizona and beyond into the United States, today's United States. And for those of you who have been fascinated or interested in Lemuria, James Churchward wrote a series of books on Lemuria, Mu. And then there's the discovery of William Niven, who, while excavating an area in Mexico, discovered these andesite tablets that had very odd reliefs on them, but also language that he didn't decipher, but kind of felt that it could be from what Church Word was thinking about. And today we have Dr. Susan Martinez on the show, and we've had Susan on before. Susan is I would consider a prolific writer. She's a linguist, teacher, as well as a paranormal researcher. She got her doctorate in anthropology from Columbia University, and she's written some interesting books. She wrote the original Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man and Time of the Quickening and some other books. And I wanted to bring Susan on because she just wrote a new book. It isn't out yet, but this is kind of a preview show. It's called The Lost Continent of Pan, The Oceanic Civilization at the Origins of World Culture. And I got a digital copy of this book, and you're going to want to get it because not only does it kind of place and show how a lot of these pyramid cultures came about, especially in the Americas, but it takes and reveals kind of a worldwide distribution of culture from a motherland, which is what we would call Lemuria. Susan, how are you today?
I'm fine.
Wonderful. Hey, great to have you back. This book must have taken you a while to put together because it's 500 pages. That's amazing.
Really? I had no idea.
Oh, that's right. You're looking at a digital copy, too. Tell our audience a little bit about Lemuria. Just kind of give us a highlight before we get into the book. Why? I mean, Lemuria, by all accounts, was a civilization that we read about that was in existence over 20,000 years ago.
Right.
It was a continent in the Pacific, known as a continental island. But what else can you tell us about them, just really quickly before we get in? Was it an actual place?
It was a very huge continent, pretty much in a triangular shape, with the northeast portion apparently touching or very close to the American Northwest coast, and the westernmost portion including Japan. Japan itself was a small portion of Pan, which broke off and survived the submersion, the grand submersion of the continent of Pan.
Mm-hmm.
I also use the word Mu because people are familiar with it from James Church Word. I don't use the word Lemuria because there's a lot of confusion surrounding that word, and it's basically a 19th century term. The original theories of Lemuria had portions of it in India and the Indian Ocean and blah, blah, blah. So it's not really a term I use. But Pan itself, according to my conclusions, was submerged 24,000 years ago. And is the motherland of man, in my opinion.
Okay,
that's a start.
Yeah, no, that's very good. No, did you reference Church Ward's books in your research? And if so, did you find his work a substantial work, or did you feel that it was based on what you found? Did it support what you were doing in your new book?
Oh absolutely. Churchward was a very visionary character. He was way ahead of his time. He opened up the whole story of Mu or Pan for mankind to contemplate. If I had to calculate where he was right and he was wrong, I would say he was right about 70% of the time and wrong about 30% of the time.
Okay.
He had some theories like the gas belts caused the flood. And
right.
We might as well establish that right now. The flood, which we know from biblical lore, is the same as what I'm calling the submersion of the continent of Pan.
Okay. Okay, and just for our reference, when you say it was destroyed 24,000 years ago, how do we know that? Do we know that from legend? Do we know that from stele or standing stones that kind of have been left to us by the Toltec or any other of these native cultures that may have had their origins in Pan?
The submersion of the continent of Pan was not a Neolithic or pre-Neolithic event, which would put it around 12,000 years ago, but twice as old as that. Most of the proto-historical studies that we've seen to date, except for Churchwood, well, maybe even Churchwood put a 12,000-year date on the sinking of the lost continent, but most of that material labels that continent Atlantis and puts it in the Atlantic Ocean and connects it up with the Ice Age and whatnot. And I don't go along with that, with those dates.
Mm-hmm.
There are, for example, there are many angles that can bring you into that 24,000-year date. For example, it was more than 20,000 years ago that this culture in Japan sprang up, the Jomon culture of highly civilized and exquisite pottery and
right.
all kinds of elements of civilization. And that's the kind of thing I associate. Similarly, Tiwanaku, other places with the date that goes to the Mesolithic and not Neolithic times.
Right. You know, yeah, go ahead.
I'll just a little coda. Japan, that name, Japan, it has the name Pan in it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Hey, tell us a little bit about this chapter on Panology, which I thought was a great title, where you, and you do this throughout your book, you show similarities in language and similarities in word structure. And you, one of the early examples are the similarities of the native people of New Zealand and how they share a similarity with the native people in Japan. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why it's significant?
Because in a continent, as opposed to the highly separated islands that we have now in the Pacific, there are certain cultural themes that run throughout. So it's not so surprising to find ritualistic and cultural items that are alike, even though they're maybe 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 miles apart in the Pacific Ocean. I'm drawn to something you could call archaeolinguistics, because I have a background in language and linguistics. I did a lot of work, a lot of the proofs and research via language similarities. And there are a lot of charts and lists of that nature that show what is otherwise inexplicable correspondences between faraway cultures.
Yes, and actually, you believe that these are all related to an original language, which you claim is one. And there was, is it 20,000 years ago that you have discovered, or you feel that, or maybe even longer, that it, the world was using a single language, which I find fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that, a single language for every culture?
A single language and
or
also
the original.
A single religion, a mother language. Just logically speaking, you have to have a mother language to explain the correspondences between places like Peru and New Zealand, or Japan and California and whatnot. I mean, when I was proofreading the book fairly recently, just before proofreading the galleys, just before they went into press, I thought, oh my God, this book is just so, it's got so many details. It's all details. And that always happens when I'm proofreading. I'm overwhelmed with the annoying details. But that's really what I set out to do, to bring as much information to bear to prove that there is a motherland behind all the cultures in the ancient world and in today's world. The word Pan, even the word Pan, I mean, those lists are really extensive. We still have it in the language when we want to say all, when we want to say everything, like the universal language that you're talking about. When we want to say all, we put the word Pan in front of it, Pan-American, Pan-Asian, etc. It's still in the language after 24,000 years, and this is not unusual.
I mean, it's just amazing that if 24,000 years ago there was a unified single language. I mean, how you discovered that is just fascinating. Just to think about one language, it would be so much easier today if we all had the same language. Can you, or do you know, the level of sophistication that the original inhabitants of Pan had? I mean, did they have a technology that we're aware of? As an example, you go into great depth about the Toltec, which you believe originated from Pan. And the Toltecs were known for their artistry, great, great artisans, engineers, and builders. I mean, we'll go into it in a little bit, but can you talk a little bit about what you believe the sophistication level was of this place?
I think it's going to come out sooner or later that there has been high civilization on our planet starting around 50,000 years ago, maybe 40,000 is a safer number, but somewhere in there, global civilization where the arts of navigation were developed as they are today, with people just sailing the seas back and forth from one place to the next. These people being navigators were also astronomers. There were schools and colleges. There was artistry as grand or maybe grander than what we have today, education. There was a high standard of living. There was agriculture. I mean, that's another thing where the Neolithic dates will have to go down the drain, because it was you can't have civilization without agriculture. So the whole concept of hunters and gatherers up till 10,000 years ago is circling the drain. And so once it is established that there were cultures, the next point of interest is that they were destroyed. And how were they destroyed? They were destroyed primarily by warfare. There is a very great untold story of the ancient past, and we're going to have to start man's civilization not 10,000 years ago with the so-called agricultural revolution of the Neolithic in the Mideast, but with the global civilization on planet Earth 40 or 50,000 years ago.
But Dr. Susan, don't we? Wouldn't you say, at some level, the technology that was brought to the Americas and as well as other parts of the world had some form of technology in it? And as an example, some of the construction, like at Tula, Mexico, the ruined city there, is so sophisticated. It's almost like they looked like they used some kind of machinery to cut the blocks and to form some of the intricate reliefs on some of the outer parts of those buildings. Is there any evidence of that? Did you find any evidence of technology in your research?
All the grandiose architecture belongs to a different culture than the survivors of Pan. It belongs to the offspring of those survivors, and their date is something like 18,000 years ago. You were talking about massive blocks before I came on.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the dimensions you were talking about, and I think that the pouring technology has to be part of that, and that researchers will probably come up with more proofs of that as time goes by. They seem too enormous to have been moved. Even modern technology couldn't move stuff that size. So I don't know. I don't focus too strongly on grand technologies. It's not my strong point.
Okay.
But I believe that it's valid. There was lost knowledge and lost technologies.
Right. You just said something that was kind of interesting. You said that our dating is off, and perhaps we need to reconsider some of our time frames. Are you saying that C14 dating is inaccurate? Are you saying that just that our understanding of the ancient past is not up to par?
Well, Cliff, you know, when you get into dating, I mean, dating is all important. It's everything when you're trying to get a firm grip on the ancient past. Dating is everything. And so whatever agenda is attached to the research, they're going to stick to their dating no matter what. They're going to fudge on the tests. And there's, I'm afraid there's quite a bit of evidence for making the dates come out right, according to your model. I can't give the specifics of that. In fact, it would be slanderous to do so. But I'm afraid that is the case. The stuff that's called science is only science to the point that you're delivering the information objectively. And that is not the case, whether it's ancient science or current, or no matter what field you're in. There has been so much distortion in order to maintain the standard model of those fields. Dating is a very touchy issue. The age of the planet itself. I mean, I've written about all these things, about the age of planet Earth, about the age of agriculture, as I mentioned before, the age of Homo sapiens. All of it is got to be revised if we want to see what was really going on in the ancient world.
Yeah, I mean, I've traveled through the Yucatan for a number of years, and it just when they say that these ruins, and I'm talking about on the Gulf side. Well, I mean, all through I've been all through Yucatan. But I went to a place called Sahil and Labna and even the great city of Uxmal, and a good portion of the city and the buildings is under, I mean, mud and dirt. It's been buried in water. And I always ask the locals about this, and they talk about the Great Flood. Now, that wasn't a few thousand years ago. That was many thousands of years ago. And it's just, to my mind, that it seems like the Maya have been misdated or improperly dated. And the elders tell me, and of course there's people like Edgar Cayce and so on and so forth, believe that a lot of the original people did come from Pan. And this is what's very curious to me. The Toltec came, we know that they came to Chichen Itza, one of the main Maya universities, and basically revolutionized a lot of the teachings, as well as built a number of new, very sophisticated structures there. And they're noted for being there maybe a couple of thousand, maybe 3,000 years ago. Now, researchers like Richard Hansen in Guatemala, who's excavating El Mirador, which is a monstrous Maya city, have recently come back with dates of 12,000 BC for corn and grain. If that's the case, then that means the Maya were contemporaries with the Olmec. So What do you say about that kind of a discovery? I mean, you just hinted on something, and I want to kind of carry a little further into the improper dating. And I guess through trial and error, these newer dates are coming up to show that you're right, Susan, that there is a real misdating of these ancient cultures that shows that Earth was populated by very sophisticated civilizations, thousands of years older than what we currently now understand.
Right.
What do you say about that?
I recall that Jeffrey Goodman had come up with a date of 20,000 years for corn grains and agricultural product, not wild grains, in the Americas. And you know, it's the same story. The powers that be, whether they're in the government or in the university, it's embarrassing for them to have their received wisdom just knocked out of the game by such old dates. So they have to ignore it or disparage it in some way. And then right after they do that, they come up with some breaking news story about finding 9,000-year corn in Central America or South America.
Yeah.
Or 10,000 year, as if they just found it, and that's their discovery. So this is standard procedure wherever you turn, that you're up against a model that won't give because it will invalidate what they have been doing and saying for decades, if not for 100 years. But the proto-history, the facts and figures we're getting at from proto-historians nowadays is going to throw that whole system out. And the early civilizations are going to come into the light of day. This has all been prophesied to happen in this time, because this is a time of change in which the revelations of the past are going to come into full view, and people will be able to think for themselves and understand and interpret for themselves what these facts mean.
Well, I'm looking forward to the revelation, because I don't know how they can keep a cap on all this, these new discoveries.
The only way to work is to just accept the fact that they're coming up with phony dates and phony conclusions, and to just forget about it and follow your own leads wherever they go, and to rest assured that there were prior civilizations that we knew nothing about until now.
I think you're right. Otherwise, you just get frustrated. You pull your hair out and scream and yell and call people names. Let's talk more about this research on this book. The book actually gets into the distribution of, or the migration of these people from Pan. How far into the world, other than, I mean, because there's a great influence of Panology or Pan culture throughout the Americans, but how much of the rest of the world is influenced, did you describe, defined by the island of Pan?
Let's take the basic facts of Panology. And I must say that I got some basic information from the OWASP Bible, which I've been studying the historical portions of it to see if they can be corroborated by things that are researchable today. And so here's the basic fact I work from. That 24,000 years ago, when the flood came down upon the continent of Pan, the chosen people, we'll use that phrase, the chosen people were notified of it spiritually in advance. And by the way, this corresponds to some of the material in our Holy Bible and in other ancient traditions, that the Noachic or Noah type was notified in advance and prepared and instructed by the angelic guides to build ships. Okay, so when this event was about to occur, the chosen people knew about it. They were told to build ships. They were given the dimensions of the ships and all the particulars by their angelic mentors. And so when they set out, they did so in five separate fleets. And they went to the five different divisions of the world. In the Bible, it's spoken of as three groups, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. But in the OWASP Bible, it's described as five groups, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, as well as Yista, which is Japan, a name for Japan, and Gautama, which is a name for America, the Americas. So there were five fleets. They set out in five different directions. They escaped the submersion of Pan, and they landed in the five different divisions of the earth and civilize those areas, because in that day and time there were only barbarians left. There had been prior culture, but due to warfare, they were destroyed. So it was a renaissance, it was a new beginning, and it took place in Shem, India, Ham, mm-hmm. Africa, Japheth, China, Yista, Japan, and Gautama, America. So those were all brothers or cousins who set out. And so to find cultural correspondences between those areas is not surprising.
Hmm. Fascinating. You also go into quite a bit of detail regarding the type of human these were, and it seems like was it the original people were a Caucasian, a white people that populated many of the eventually populated after the destruction of Pan a lot of the islands that were left, which I find quite interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, they are basically described as Caucasian and little people as well, which ties in with some previous research I did, small stature people and Caucasian. But it's currently under debate. I have a colleague who thinks that some of the survivors of Pan were dark-skinned people. And so we've been debating that back and forth. And so it's still an open question. But in many of the world's traditions, there is a mythology of a pale white-skinned race coming and civilizing the people. And I've got plenty of those stories in the book. So that seems to form a general picture that they were of the Caucasian type.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting.
They mingled with the indigenous people, and in many places they were dark-skinned. So the offspring and the generations that followed were of different types. And eventually the builders of the great monuments that you like talking about because of your interest in the architecture of Mexico, those builders were the offspring of these settlers, and they were large men, and they were copper-colored men.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because that's what I was going to talk about next, is that you, in your book, give a lot of detail to the great ruins of Central America, Teotihuacan, Tula, Cholula, which is a monstrosity of a pyramid. So there must have been pyramids on Pan, because there's so many pyramids in ancient Mexico that it's just amazing. Is that what basically you're saying, is that this is a pyramid culture?
The migrants, the settlers, the people who survived Pan in five fleets were not the builders. It was generations that they proliferated from their intermarriage with the indigenous people, who became the tall, brazen builders of a grandiose architecture. They were a different race.
Okay, because when you see Teotihuacan or any of these big Mayan cities throughout Mexico, they are engineering wonders, and there's just no way that a simple people can sit down over a few decades and build one of those complexes. It has to be researched and developed over, if not decades, hundreds of years, to get to something like the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan. I mean, that's a monstrosity.
Well, those were the sun kingdoms, and the time frame for the great grandiose sun kingdoms was in the Mesolithic. In other words, most of them would probably be datable between 10 and 20,000 years ago.
Okay.
And I put a lot of energy in the book into describing the people of the Sun Kingdoms and how, you see, I'm not that interested in megaliths because it's just not the part of the ancient past that intrigues me.
Right.
But what I do understand is that they were the progeny of the chosen people who came from Pan. They were a different race because of the hybridizations that were going on, and they were ultimately the tyrants of the Mesolithic. Those that was, in many cases, that was slave labor that erected those buildings. And so I don't go into adulation of them because I'm sort of a minimalist myself, personally.
Okay.
I like the simplification of life, not the grandiose expression of it. And behind the grandiosity is was a great deal of despotism in that time.
Yeah, it's funny because you actually write about this. The bloodletting of a lot of these people that would eventually be descendants of Pan. Why did they turn so dark and get into mass sacrifice like the Aztecs turned into? It just blows my mind. We have records from the conquistadors of these tens of thousands of people being sacrificed.
It has the answer. We have to shift into almost into metaphysics to answer that, because the answer has to do with the growth of mankind and the maturity of mankind. I've gotten into different areas of my research and writing recently, I'm identifying the present time in which we live as the new era. It's called the Cosmon era. It's cosmic man. And it is the point in which humanity truly matures. Up to the point of maturity, we have gone through many phases. And in the earlier times, there was always a split off between the conquerors and monument builders and the holy people. I think we're coming into a replay of that in the present time. I think we're currently involved in a split off of the gentle people from the conquerors, if you will. So it's
Are you referring to Donald as our new president?
I reckon I am.
Okay, well, that was very subtle, Dr. Susan. That was a very subtle approach.
Well, you know, we finally live in a time where it's going to become very clear that we have a choice between earthly goals and more heavenly spiritual goals, toward which path of fulfillment do we really want? And talk about dividing. It's such a big thing now since Tuesday, November 8th, this whole thing of dividing, and the prophecy that I'm working on and that I want to write about in the future, it's about the dividing of the way, which is predicted to occur in our day and in the generations to come, between the materialist minded and the spiritual minded. The second that Trump was elected for president, Obama and Hillary and everybody was scouting around to say, let's stay united. Well, Cliff, that's one way, one point of view, but there is another point of view that we are really dividing up here, because there will be no reconciling between the gentle path of life and the more brutal path, which mankind has chosen up till now. But now there is the chance of taking our fellow men and living communally and peacefully. For the first time, that's really possible on a massive scale. And I'm also writing about the gun culture, and that's another area we're not going to reconcile. These are black and white paths. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, that's a way of tying in what I've done so far and what I want to do from now on to in my writing in talking about humanity, where we've been and where we're going and where we could go if we want to.
That's fascinating. Let's go back to the island of Pan just for a second. You mentioned the little people. And you said that they were the ones who educated the Toltecs and some of the other groups that left the island. And they, the little people, you actually wrote a whole book on them. And I'm not going to pronounce it. Is it the Aihin race?
Perfect.
Okay. So talk a little bit about them. And where did they get their incredible knowledge? They must be a very ancient and long-lived people.
And you even pronounced my name right.
I hope so.
Thank you. You want me to talk about the little people?
Just a little bit about their influence in Pan, because you do describe how the Toltec and some of the other people were educated by these little people.
There was we're talking about the early races.
Yeah.
So we kind of moving into paleontology.
That old, huh? Very, very old.
Yeah. Where we're looking at the size of skeletons of Homo sapiens that have been discovered in different parts of the world. Not to say that there aren't little people on the world today. There are little people all over the place in Central Africa are the Pygmies, and there are Negritos and many of the islands, Sumatra, Philippines, even little people enclaves in South America. So there's still, the little people gene is still in the gene pool today, so there's no denying it. Actually, they tried to deny it. Wherever you turn in the anthropology literature, they either don't even bother trying to explain it, or don't even footnote the size of these people, or they try to explain littleness of fossil remains by some Cretan disease or something like that. But that's all nonsense. One of the original races here on Earth was a diminutive race. They were called the Aihins. They lived on every continent in the earliest times, but they were the holy people. They were the only, at one point, they were the only people on Earth who had religion. They were the founders of religion on Earth. They were in a kind of constant communion with the angel world. They had the gift of clairvoyance and communication. That's how it was in the early time.
And what were they, when you said little people, they were what, 2 feet, 5 inches, 3 feet? What was the average skeletal?
3 feet.
So they were small.
3 feet tall. 3 feet tall, very well proportioned, quite attractive, refined bone structure. This is recognizable in the morphology of fossil finds in different parts of the world, but not that much because they were cremators. So see, you're right,
right
there, you know, you've got a missing record.
A
but
lot.
There are other ways.
Yeah.
The folklore of almost every tribe on Earth has material on the little people, and they were usually they're usually called the teachers, or they're called the sacred little people. This is a lot in the North American tribes, known as the they were known as the sacred little people. Right here where I live in the old Cherokee area, down here in Georgia, there's a vast Cherokee literature on the little people who preceded them before the Cherokee migrated into this area. This is a universal fact. I mean, it's there. But it has not been established. You know, it's just it's a closed door there. Like I say, in the universities and in the professional field, it has not yet been recognized as an early and quite prominent race of man.
Okay.
But it will. It will. You'll see it. I mean, what about those findings they had in on the Isle of Flores near Bali in 2004? You know, Homo floresiensis. They found them in some caves. They found these 3-foot skeletons.
Isn't that The Hobbit?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah,
The Hobbit. Yeah.
Right.
Very strange. Diminutive.
And they made a big hullabaloo about them. And oh, isn't this a wonderful, fantastic findings? Well, they knew about them a century ago, but you know, they were never properly incorporated in the literature, and yet those hobbits on the island of Flores near Bali, they were mixed. You see, they were a hybrid, so they were little, and they had some modern morphology, but they also had some very archaic morphology, and they still don't understand that. All it is mixing. All it ever was racial mixing. It wasn't part of any evolutionary explanation. They didn't evolve at all. Mm-hmm. The races just mixed. And so they got the stature of the original Aihin people, but that was mixed in with some of the more primitive traits of the indigenous tribes.
Wow. You know, it's funny. I was thinking, and I know you don't get into what you call the monument builders, but in Uxmal, which is a very old city in Yucatan, Mexico, there's a pyramid. It's called the Pyramid of the Magician. And the myth of that pyramid is that a dwarf built it overnight. And
I think they call. Did they also call it the Temple of the Dwarfs?
I'm not sure.
They call it the Temple of the Dwarfs, or there's another building. I know it's Uxmal. Another building in Uxmal called Temple of the Dwarfs, and we really should ignore the word dwarf. It's just a mistranslation. It really should be Temple of the Little People in honor of the their cultural founders.
Have you been to Uxmal and seen that? That's one of the most beautiful. Of course, it's been reproduced and it was built in five different periods. But the final pyramid is just gorgeous. It's huge.
I
just like
Palenque,
amazed.
And I didn't even have the nerve to walk up the steps. I stood below as my husband and son walked up the steps of Palenque. And it's beautiful there, too.
Yeah, yeah. I think some people unconsciously realize that when they do climb the pyramid, they're being bathed in energy, so it kind of upsets them. And we do know now, and I think I've mentioned to you this a couple of times offline here, is that they people like John Burke, who's not with us anymore, have found that a lot of these temples were built over geomagnetic fields, and they now know in Chichen Itza that the main El Castillo pyramid, the pyramid, is built over a cenote, a river, and also an energy field, a geomagnetic field. So that thing's activated. So when you say you were reticent about walking up the stairs, you probably on some level thought, well, you know, I'm not sure I want to get nailed with this energy.
No, it's not that, Cliff. I'm just a scaredy cat. You know, they're just exposed steps. There's no, you know, I'm just a little old lady.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's no rail or anything.
I'm going to be taking people to on a tour in April, and we're going to be going to a couple of these places. And Uxmal, the Great Pyramid, is the only one you can go to, which is the one that's partly still partly exposed, and a good portion of it is unexcavated just because it's just Mexico doesn't have the money to do it. But you can climb to the very top of that pyramid. And when you're up there, you can feel something radiating up and through your body. It's pretty amazing. It's fascinating. That's why I was asking you about technology, because it's really curious how these things, they're like machines of some kind, but we just don't know what kind of machine. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
Pretty fascinating.
But when I have a technology question, I go to Bill Becker, an architect, inventor friend of mine he's a disciple of Buckminster Fuller.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Bill has all the technology know-how that I don't have.
Yeah. Well, no, your highlights in this book are fascinating, wonderful, and very informative, and so we appreciate your gifts. So, but let's talk about something that I want to bring up, and I found this just a couple of days ago. You show a very interesting comparison to the historic Mu and the fabled Atlantis. And I think, and I didn't finish the entire chapter, I think that you feel that there's a lot of confusion and that Mu may actually have been Atlantis, and that Atlantis and Mu are one. Is that correct assumption, or am I off?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. I view
Tell us
Atlantis.
About that. I want to hear more about your assumptions on that.
I'm glad you called it the fabled Atlantis, because that's exactly what I think it is—a fable. Not based on truth. I believe the true motherland of man was in the Pacific Ocean, and mm-hmm. that those migrations occurred the way I described them, and that there's a very little of humanity that we can pinpoint to the Atlantic Ocean as any kind of homeland. Certainly there must have been islands that have since subsided, but I think Atlantis has gotten all the credit for what Mu deserves. And I started out, I mean, years ago, when I first started studying these things, I started out with Atlantis, so just like everybody else. But I came to believe that it is a myth. And when I had to actually confront it and write about my beliefs, I came to see that the Atlantis that the ancients talked about, let's say Plato, because mm-hmm. that's what the myth was founded on, some verses from Plato, that the true Atlantis was America.
Interesting.
Yeah, they didn't know what was going on the other side of the ocean, but they had bits and pieces of it, and that many of these early descriptions actually conform to descriptions of America, of Mexico, of Peru, of North America, and so on. Atlantis was America, in my opinion. I don't think there ever was a continent with people living on it and spreading their culture from that point.
Hmm. That's a fascinating assumption. I've always been curious about these ruins in Yucatan and throughout Mexico, because they're not simple. We've been told that these the Maya and maybe the last descendants of the great Maya and their earlier civilizations were wearing loincloths and were animalistic and so on and so forth. But the people who, the originating builders of these great pyramid complexes, were very sophisticated people, and it would make sense if those were Atlanteans who eventually morphed into Maya after the Great Flood. Fascinating thought. Fascinating. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you know Dr. Danny Hillerman. He's the geologist who is excavating Penang, Gunung Penang in Java, Indonesia, or Danny Urwurtu. They've both written books based on what they believe is an island called, they call the Mu, or the island, ancient island in the Pacific, Atlantis. They claim that's Atlantis. So,
well, it's just, okay.
It's weird.
But it's,
you know,
a
what
wrong,
I mean?
It's obviously, it's a laughably wrong name, because Atlantis is based on our familiarity with the Atlantic ocean. So it's terribly confusing. I don't think students and readers should be confused like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Plato left an indelible, I mean, he left a real impression on everybody with his story of Atlantis, and it's morphed into what it is today. So who knows? Hey, in the little time we have left, I have a few questions, and then I want you to kind of give us an idea of what you want people to be taking away from this new book of yours. Churchward created a map of what is currently the United States, and he describes a number of areas like the Kentucky area and the Pueblo area and the Oregon area. Is it your belief that sophisticated people migrated up into those areas of the United States?
Oh, well, if you give me a time frame, I might be able to better answer your question.
10,000 BC.
And you said sophisticated people?
Yeah, I mean, we know from the native elders that there was a migration from Mexico, present-day Mexico, up into Arizona and the other current native areas. But it seems like there was even greater migration that isn't really talked about that much into eastern United States and into the Pacific side, which is interesting to note.
Like I say, there was a global culture. I believe there was a global culture before the Neolithic Age, and that that 10,000-year time frame, 10,000 years ago time frame would be just about pre-Neolithic. People were sailing back and forth across the great seas of the world, and so almost any sort of foreign migration would be reasonable. But that's different than the Hopi people coming up from Mexico. That is a flow of migration that's connected with the five fleets from Pan. The fleet that landed in America 24,000 years ago, landed in the Guatemala area. Guatemala, when you look at the name, is Guatemala, and the ancient name for that fleet and for the Americas was Guatemala. So there's that little connection right there, kind of like a corroboration of what we're saying, that the fleet to America was called Guatama, the continent was named Guatama, and the landing place was Guatemala. There's quite a bit of evidence that the Hopi came up from Central America, and I wish I had your elder Clifford, had your elder Clifford information to include in the book, because it seems to say the same thing.
Yeah, I think we talked about that a few months ago. Another Native culture that you talk a great deal about that has a wide breadth of influence is the Kuishi. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that civilization, because there seems to be bits and pieces of it in the Nazca people of Peru, of different Native tribes up and down the Central American area, and maybe as far as the northern United States.
Yeah, this was an interesting area for me as a researcher, because, and as an archaeolinguist, because the name quiche, and you could spell that a lot of ways. You could spell it like the cheese dish, quiche is spelled, or you could spell it kish, K-I-S-H, which is how the Mesopotamians in the Near East spelled it. Kish, or you could spell it Quechua, the way the Peruvians have it, or the Quiche culture of Mexico. So there's a name that comes up in all kinds of disparate places, but seems to have a common origin. And it seems to connect with the Five Fleets, with the dispersion from Pan, because wherever you have it, you have high culture coming into that region.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
You know, what? I was just going to say, your Orthodox scientists say, I found this while I was researching this problem. They say there's no connection between the quiche of Mexico and the Quechua of the Andes. Hey, it's almost the same word. And the dispersion of the people throughout the Americas, according to the model I'm using, started in Guatemala. They went north and they went south. They traveled through the interior. They didn't reach the oceans in either case. Going south, they became the Quechua language of the Andes. Mm-hmm. Going north, they became the Quiche people of the Mayan area. So that's how I interpreted that one name.
If you would, if you had a vision for how this book is perceived by the reader, what is your biggest goal? That they understand that, and I'm just going to put some words in your mouth, but you can tell me what you believe. But my interpretation of what I read in your book so far is that you want people to have a thorough understanding for this very, very ancient civilization and its world influence is what I feel, but I think there's more to it. You drill down and you get into specifics of cultural diversity. You get into what they left us and things like that. But what do you want people to come away with in this wonderful book? And I it's going to take me a while to read it. It's over 500 pages, but it's interesting.
That's a great question, Cliff. I like that question. It's original. I find that nowadays interviews they've been gravitating toward a certain standard question, which is, what surprised you most about blah, blah, blah? And, yeah. You know, it's just become such a cliche. But for you to ask, what were my goals? That's a much more relevant question. And I can hardly think of an answer except to say that we've got to go back to the drawing board. We have the standard orthodox textbook model, okay? And then we have the new orthodoxy, that's what I call it, the new age writers, and they're all talking about Atlantis. So now I'm up against two orthodoxies, not just one, because you've got a point, counterpoint, and now I'm jumping in on both of them and saying they're both wrong, and that what we really have to look for as the original homeland and the source of civilization, and that excludes astronauts also. That excludes ancient astronauts, that there is a high civilization that survived, that 24,000 years ago survived only in one place on the Earth, and that was on the continent of Pan. But when the chosen people, even there, were threatened, because there had been genocide over the entire planet, except for on Pan. And when the chosen people on Pan were threatened, that's when the continent went down, and they were the sole survivors and brought civilization to the many places on the planet. My goal, I guess you could say my goal was to complete my work on ancient mysteries, because it came as the third in a series of books. You know, you mentioned the Little People book and then the Hybrid Man book, and they were all about what was really going on in the early time of humanity. And the continent of Pan is the finishing touch, because you need that to complete the story of what really went on and what we really should look at as our own past. My goal was to my goal, Cliff, was to get it out of my system.
Well, I guess, you know, if you look at reincarnation, we all come in with a goal, and that this was a big one, and this is the final book of your trilogy, which is, I have to say, congratulations. I'm looking forward to going through it and using it in support of my studies on Mayan culture, and the Toltecs are a big part of it.
Cliff, are you going to be getting a hard copy of the book?
Your publicist said that I would get a copy at some point.
Stay on with me afterwards so we can make sure you get a hard copy of it.
I'll check in with you after the program and we can talk about it. Let me ask you one last question. Yeah, no sweat. Here's a question that I normally don't ask, but I am a deeply spiritual person, and I believe there's a lot of unseen forces that guide our lives. Each individual is a specific life and has a specific goal to obtain, and so on and so forth. But where does this book touch us on a spiritual level? I mean, you may not be able to answer this, but I think you can. It's an important book. I think it's a very important book, and I think people need to consider reading it. And I hope that, I wish that your publisher would have do an audio version of the book. I found that these some books that are read by the authors are actually better comprehended, because for some reason the intonation of the and the voice of the author really helps understand the concepts. But anyhow, to my first question, what is, on a spiritual, on a higher level, is the message of the book?
Well, I'm really delighted that you said what you just said. In a way, I've avoided the spiritual issues because, you know, we wanted to get down to some nitty-gritty archaeology questions and stuff like that. But my next book is called Spiritology. I want to clarify the issues in that area as well. They all tie in, but there are three main branches of knowledge, in my opinion. There's history, there's science, and there's spirituality. They all tie in, but we can kind of handle them separately. Now, if we wanted to expand on the spiritological aspect of this story, the Pan story, we would go deeper into what these survivors were like, who these Aihin people were, these little people who set out on the five fleets. They were the people who, in the five regions where they landed, became the priestly class, the holy people, the sacred little people. There's a whole separate story for that. They were also the civilizers, the teachers, and whatnot. Record of folklore throughout the world substantiates this to a very great degree. The story of humanity is not complete when we just talk about the giant monuments here, there, and everywhere. We need to see what the underlying story is and how the races developed to that point. These little people, the sacred people, the survivors of the continent of Pan, were the only spiritually developed people on Earth. I guess their story is told in the other book I wrote, The Lost History of the Little People. I'm a spiritualist. I look at things spiritually. I think that spiritual understanding has to do with what we know and what we can learn about this life and the afterlife. Understanding the afterlife is very important. To me, no story is complete without looking at the spiritual side of it, and I'm very involved in it. Actually, in my own writing, I started out, my first book was on a spiritual topic. It was called The Psychic Life of Abraham Lincoln. And it explored his spiritual life and how very important it was at that time and for the man he was and for the things he accomplished. And a lot of it was accomplished through his connection to the angel world. And I wrote a few more things on the spiritual topic. And then I turned to the history side of knowledge. And I wrote these three books, this trilogy that you called it, on ancient knowledge of ancient times. I'm done with that. I guess I could go on for a few more hours about spiritualism, but we'll get back together when I've got that next book out on spiritology.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, fantastic. The book, again, The Lost Continent of Pan. My guest today has been Dr. Susan Martinez, and wonderful book. I guess the book's coming out in December. The publisher is Bear & Company, Inner Traditions, actually. It's the parent company. And do you have a website, Susan, people can go to and look a little bit, look at this the content, or should they go to the Inner Traditions site for more information?
Right, the latter.
Okay, super. Okay, super. All right. Hey, really enjoyed the conversation, much luck on this book. And for those of you that are listening, it is filled with great photographs, wonderful graphs on language, comparisons on various types of humanity, diversity, and just a whole, it's really a fine piece, and it's one of those books that needs to be on your bookshelf as a reference. So great work, and much luck on that book.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Cliff.
Okay, we'll be back with you, Susan. Take care. So that was Susan Martinez and the book, The Lost Continent of Pan. I just started looking at it, went through some chapters, and, of course, I'm fascinated by the Toltec, just an amazing race of beings that influenced the Maya. I think they absorbed into the Maya and probably the Aztecs and others and built magnificent pyramid complexes, which I'm fascinated in. As a reminder, my guest next week is Mike Berra. Mike Berra has a new book on NASA and the ancient world, also a lot of the manipulation by NASA. I have a huge new announcement to make that I will make at the end of the year about a new book on Carl Sagan. I think it's going to be one of these books that really wakens people up to his beliefs about ancient aliens and alien contact. The author is perhaps the foremost authority on Carl Sagan, who's been dead now 20 years. It's 20 year anniversary of his passing. That will be in the new year, but Mike Berra will give us a hint about this and some of the dealings that NASA has with the general public, and so much going on in that organization. So next week, Mike Berra and his new book on NASA. I hope you have a great holiday. And remember, the tour for the Maya, Path of the Sacred Maya, is April 2nd through 8th. There's a new pricing. I've dropped the price significantly. I hope you can join me. We only can take 20 people. I think we're about half full. So go to the website, www.earthancients.com, and register for that event. It's going to be a blast. We're going to do a lot of really cool stuff. So I hope you have a great day and a great holiday.